CA Technologies is pleased to present a panel discussion on identity-aware data loss prevention, how to manage and protect sensitive information on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
I'm Tom Temin, and our guests today are Peter Gouldman, National Policy Coordinator in the Office of Information Assurance at the State Department, Brian Burns, Deputy Director, Warfighter Systems Integration in the Air Force CIO Office, Simone Zickman, CIO of the Department of Commerce, and from CA Technologies, Gijo Matthew, Vice President of Security Strategy. Great to have you all. And let's start with the current environment right now. Cybersecurity, the threat environment changes, the technologies we use change, and also there's policy changes. There's new guidance coming from NIST, updated guidance on FISMA compliance, for example. And there's also some pending legislation. We don't know where that's going to head exactly, but the scene seems to be changing. So starting with you, Peter Gouldman from State Department, what are some of the framework and policy issues that you're looking at to make sure that in cybersecurity you're keeping up with where the world is going?
Thank you, Tom. The world is clearly changing from when we started with FISMA in 2002, where we were concerned very much with how secure our systems are. And we're moving our focus generally across the board in the government towards a greater interest in what's going on with the information, where it's traveling, what it's being used for. And not too terribly long ago in 2007, the Office of Management and Budget came out with a memorandum requesting all of the organizations in the federal government to take a hard look at what they're doing with information, specifically focused in areas of personally identifiable information, so that we can get a better handle on how much of it we should be keeping, where we should be keeping it, and what we should be doing to protect it where we're keeping it. So there were a number of measures that came into place at that time, and agencies have been focused on implementing new approaches, whether it's policy or technologies, to deal with that particular issue.
And Brian Burns from the Air Force CIO office, what are you seeing in the military side?
Well, we have similar issues that the other organizations have, and we're also following the OMB guidance. If you think about it, we still have the bottom line issues of data at rest and also establishing policies in removable media and user authentication. So we're looking at areas to help in defining how we protect the information. For example, the Air Force, we receive a message every day that states memory sticks, thumb drives, and camera flash drives, removable media are unauthorized on the systems. And the point of that is to identify devices that could increase the loss of data if not properly stored. And then also it helps us with the risk of making sure the proper controls are contained around the data. And then, of course, the devices themselves, the encryption on the devices and the capabilities there so that we have components that are properly protected and don't have malware onto the actual devices themselves as they're deployed, since they are more of a soft solution than a hard solution.
And Simone Zickman from Department of Commerce, you're joining us by telephone, we should add. What is the view of Commerce Department with respect to policy development?
Well, I would say clearly the issue of personally identifiable information remains at the forefront of people's awareness. There's a lot of internal policy development in that area. We've recently established a new position of a chief privacy officer, updated our PII, personally identifiable information breach response plan, and have other policies either issued or under development. But I would say that that's also just part of the equation. There's the more general need to protect sensitive information of various sorts, and personally identifiable information is one of those types of information, and one that we're very familiar with since the Census Bureau deals with that type of information in very large volumes, the Census Bureau being one of the bureaus within the Department of Commerce. Of course, we also have other types of sensitive information throughout the department, and a key challenge remains just understanding where it is, and as was said previously, how it's being protected both when it's at rest and when it's moving around within our networks.
Okay, I see a PII theme emerging here, but we're going to get back to that. But first, from Gijo Matthew, the VP of Security Strategy at CA Technologies, what is the technology world doing to respond to some of these concerns that you're hearing? Because I imagine you hear them across the board.
Absolutely. And it's been interesting because we've been calling ourselves information security professionals for so long, yet we actually never protect information. We protect things around information, and we hope and most of the time pray that we are actually securing that securing the data itself. And enter what's happening with data loss prevention. By being able to analyze data itself, where we can now put rules and restraints around it to kind of protect it and control it better. And to tell you the truth, data loss prevention, losing the data is only one use case, right? It's bad that we lose data, especially personally identifiable information, but that's kind of a symptom to a bigger problem, which is really lack of control of data. And to be able to protect data, you need to have better control, regardless of the fact if it's leaving the organization or agency, but you know, even used within the agency. Or organization as well. So what's happening now is technology is really changing to leverage the intelligence that we gather about data and then leverage that and integrate that with all the rest of the security stuff that we've been doing for a long time now, right? And it's now what we're doing. Now what we're doing is really adding content intelligence to the existing controls that we have in our organizations today. And that's how the technology is changing to really just.
And Brian Burns had mentioned a few minutes ago devices and cell phones and so forth. And I think that's another trend we're seeing, and maybe you can comment. And what's inspiring this question is one of you, and we won't say who, has an iPad. And, of course, those are difficult for organizations to deal with. And so I think that's an example of what we're seeing is consumerization or consumer devices coming into the corporate network because that's the way people want to work. And can you comment, Peter Goldman?
Sure. And that's one of the primary challenge areas, as you point out, because, you know, users in doing their job are looking for greater and greater flexibility to support mobile work, right? We don't sit at a desk like we used to years ago. We're out and about and we're meeting with people, and especially in the State Department, diplomacy requires that you be out there and really getting involved in the work where the work is. And because of that, there's an outcry for people to be able to have these flexible technologies. The challenge in having that is that you have to figure a way to provide that support and that mobility and do so in a way that protects the data that we're trying to manage. And that it provides, as I said, a lot of challenge. And organizations like State are trying to figure out the right way to balance the risk of exposing information to harm with the need to provide support for how the mission success is achieved.
And in the Air Force, you've got a lot of civilian workers and you've got a lot of young airmen that like their devices just as much as anybody. And we never dreamed we'd have devices we're walking around with 20, 30, 40, 50, 100, you know, gigabytes of information, maybe approaching a terabyte. So what does the Air Force see there?
Well, we are going through a cultural change from the baby boomer generation into the millennial generation. And one of the interesting things is as a newer technology comes out, if you think about it, convenience is almost the opposite of security and privacy. So you really have to balance the three areas of convenience, security, and privacy in terms of the mission and also the legal constraints. From a warfighter perspective, we need access to appropriate information anywhere at any time in a secure manner. And as mentioned, the traditional office is changing at the same time, but the contracts for secure storage of information and accessing the records are still there in terms of whether it's paper, plastic, metal, or mineral. And as the technology changes, the landscape changes. For instance, with IPv6 coming on board and cloud computing, we're really beginning to move from a castle paradigm into more of a island paradigm. Meaning that instead of just protecting the perimeter, we're now protecting the information and where it's hosted, and then the network at that point is just the connection points between there, which really means we need to take more of a net-centric or an information-centric approach and start tagging the information in terms of different dimensions, such as the authoritative source, the authoritative location, the security, the privacy, the content, and the context of the information. And if you think about it in the music industry, digital rights management is a key aspect of identifying the intellectual property and also the copyright capabilities. From a warfighting standpoint, those type of technologies could be used so that we have the integrity and the confidentiality of the information sustained as we move forward in those directions. And what that allows us to do then is, since the data would be located anywhere at any time, we really need to encapsulate the data in appropriate security controls so that we have the proper tagging encryption, which means the key management of the encrypted data will be the critical aspect as we move forward. And then authoritative privileges will then have to be matched with the security attributes of the information in order for the user to access the information. And that's kind of, if you think about it, cognitively, we have redacted information manually within documents for decades. But now what we're looking is there a similar technology that can electronically do that over the internet that will basically take the security and the privacy classification or encapsulation of that data and then match it up with the user privileges so that we have the appropriate information at the appropriate time. And if we can do that, then if the data is not properly tagged and the authoritative sources cannot be verified, then the integrity of the data would be in question, whether we're using it straight out or mashing up the data. So again, access anywhere to information, we have to make sure that we put the appropriate security parameters around it so we can identify that information as being accurate at the time we need to use it.
Yeah, so that puts the whole data management and device management as kind of one big complex of activity. And so, Simone, the Commerce Department probably knows that 53 million Americans have smartphones now. Some of them work at Commerce and have these kinds of devices. What's your view on where we're headed this way?
I think definitely the mobility issue that was commented on previously is going to become an increasing driver in terms of how the government decides to architect its security, the types of policies it needs to have in place, and how people do their work. Certainly, smartphones are increasing in use. Tablet-type machines like iPads and other new ones that are going to be hitting the market are going to be things that are increasingly desired. And there's also the increasing trend and pressure to increase the use of telework within the federal government. And so all of these things in different ways affect the mobile user. The idea of having a perimeter that you can easily defend is really becoming increasingly antiquated, and so the need to be able to come up with architectures and policies that really enable us to keep control of information, understand how it needs to be protected, and to actually implement those protections is I think going to become more difficult in the future.
And Gijo, you know, CA's roots and many other vendors and many people's training have the roots in controlled systems where you had a mainframe and terminals and maybe even client server systems, but didn't have the multiplicity of devices and locations and inputs that networks experience now. So how is the vendor side responding? What are the technologies coming along to make that so that it is manageable within the 24-hour day?
Right. So security is changing from, you know, like the way Brian put it, from a castle model to an island model. And it's not just about the infrastructure security capabilities that we have in our environments anymore. It's not about the walls that we can build or monitoring those walls or whatever it might be. It's really about transactional security now. It's how can I make sure the user A gets access to data B, and how can I make sure that is authorized, authenticated, and monitored, regardless of the infrastructure that's running on, because it may not be the same infrastructure. It might be virtualized infrastructure. You know, who knows? It might be cloud-based infrastructure somewhere else. And what we need to do is really think about it from a transactional perspective. And when you do that, you start thinking about a couple of different things. One, identity. Identity has to be a key piece of this. How do we authenticate and know who the people are on one end? Forget the device for a second. We'll start back at the identity and say, how can we make sure that we know this is Tom, this is Gijo, this is Brian, and how do we make sure that's the right person accessing the right set of data? So once we get to that first piece, and it's a lot like airport security in a way, right? You have to present your identity, you have to verify your passport, your driver's license, then you get a boarding pass, right? And then you have the right authorization level. And that authorization level has to be managed. So that might include things like, well, he's coming on his iPad, and because he's coming on his iPad at a location we don't know, he won't be able to access this set of data, right? But that's not the only thing that happens at airport security. There's also another layer of security that happens, which is the content check, right? We have to go through those screeners and make sure there's no content in our bags that we're not supposed to be bringing on board a plane. And the same thing kind of holds true for the next level of the transaction, which is, okay, I know who you are, I've given you authorization, but are you supposed to get to the data that you're going for? And that's a really hard and tricky piece. And Brian had mentioned a lot of things around classification of data, and we've lived that world for a long time, especially here in federal, we really understood the idea of classification. The problem now, though, is that data is a lot more dynamic when it's digital, right? And classifications aren't the old paper classifications that we could have, because cut and paste works everywhere now, right? And you can take that data and move it around and change it whenever you need to. So user-based classification is going to be pretty much impossible, right, for many organizations. And what we need to do is understand the type of data and analyze it dynamically, and dynamically classify that information and tie it all the way back to the identity on what device and what piece of data that they're trying to access. And then you can enable things like better digital rights management on those things. And then you can enable things like better encryption, but by being selective of who's using that data in that transaction.
Now, of course, that changes the picture of the way we look at cybersecurity. For many, many years, it has been a perimeter issue, you know, the castle issue. And this goes back to the 80s and 70s before they called it cybersecurity. It's, you know, anti-phone phreaking and that kind of thing. And so how do these new approaches and these new technologies that engender those approaches affect the way we approach the old-fashioned perimeter security, because we still need that? Why don't we start with you, Simone?
I think one of the things that we're grappling with right now is how to take the existing technologies that are available. Some of the capabilities that people have already mentioned are things that we can do today. The question is, how do you really architect them into a large-scale security system to protect a large set of assets, say a whole set of department systems rather than a single particular system with a certain set of functions. And that's where the need to do some proper architecting becomes important. Otherwise, it's easy to end up with a patchwork of different tools being used in different places for different reasons. And I think that evolutionary maturing process is something that is going on across the federal government. Within the Department of Commerce, we are using many different types of tools, but I would say that they tend to be driven by local requirements and not necessarily being used in every single location where they might have some benefit. We're using tools ranging from encryption of laptops, full disk encryption, to file encryption for doing secure file transfer. We have data loss prevention appliances monitoring the perimeter for leaks of information that we don't want leaving. But the idea of coming up with a holistic understanding of where data is, what levels of sensitivity are applied to which data, and then systematically applying certain sets of controls in all cases where those controls should be applied is something that's still an ongoing process.
It's like everyone's become the Port Authority. It's filled with people coming and going. It never closes, and yet you still have to keep it secure, I guess. And in the Air Force, Brian Burns, you've got people operating in all the time zones of the world, and not just here on Earth. You know, they're up in the sky. And so how does perimeter security get impacted by the changes we've been describing?
Well, we're always going to have legacy systems, and we're going to have traditional perimeter security that we're going to have to deal with. But if you think about it, as we move forward into the cloud, it really gets back to our net-centric and our information-centric strategy of really focusing on the information that we're trying to transport. And as I mentioned, encapsulating the security and the privacy around that and the authoritative data source of that information. By doing that, then we have a higher level of confidence in the information that we're using. And then it comes down to an issue of how do you manage the keys around the encryption, and how do you manage the keys around the authentication of the user being a warfighter at the appropriate time with that information. So it's a little bit different model. Instead of focusing just on the system and the network, it's now really focusing on the user with the information of which it happens to be located someplace on a system at a given point in time. But that becomes a secondary component versus the actual management of the information and the security and privacy around that.
Okay, we're going to continue this discussion in just a moment. But first, we're going to take a brief commercial break. You're listening to a panel discussion on identity-aware data loss prevention, how to manage and protect sensitive information, presented by CA Technologies here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
How do you keep your infrastructure safe without limiting your people and productivity? CA Technologies lets you control every use of every IT asset by everyone who accesses your systems. Can you say yes to new capabilities? Can you enforce defense in detail, not just defense in depth? Can you empower your people while protecting your systems? With CA Technologies, you can. To learn how, visit ca.com/gov/value.
Welcome back to a panel discussion on identity-aware data loss prevention, how to manage and protect sensitive information, presented by CA Technologies here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Tom Temin. Our guests today are Peter Gouldman, National Policy Coordinator, Office of Information Assurance at the State Department, Brian Burns, Deputy Director of Warfighter Systems Integration at the Air Force's CIO Office, and Simone Zickman, CIO, Department of Commerce, and also Gijo Matthew is Vice President of Security Strategy at CA Technologies. And we wanted to wind up the discussion we had about the perimeter versus the island or the castle versus the island approach and what effect the islandization of cyber has on the perimeter security we've been practicing so many years, and we didn't get that answer yet from Peter Gouldman from State Department. So what's your take on that?
Well, I think there's been a lot of talk about how the perimeter is dead. And the reality is you learn early on in this business that it's not an either or, it's an and. And so when we talk about the perimeter, it's not so much dead as it's being added to. And organizations that connect out to the internet, I mean, there's a well-known initiative in the government called the Trusted Internet Connectivity. And the idea is to reduce the number of pathways that you go to out to the unknown, so to speak, so that you can manage the security of that interaction much better. And we would be remiss in our duties as security professionals to not protect that with some sort of perimeter. But at the same time, we talked about the mobile aspects of what we do, and we go outside of that perimeter when we're working out and abroad, and we have to find ways to come back through. So what we're essentially doing is we're evaluating each individual operating environment and the surrounds of where the business is taking place and the technology that's being leveraged to support that, and figured out the appropriate protections. And I think, as Gijo said, the amount of data and the type of data that goes based on the geography you're working in, so that we can balance the protections that we use. So I would say the perimeter is still here and it's here to stay, but we're adding on to it and morphing the way that it works.
And speaking of morphing the perimeter, that brings us to the topic that's on a lot of federal agencies' minds these days, or really two topics. One is cloud computing, and this is an imperative that the administration is pursuing pretty strongly. And the other is virtualization. They're not exactly telling people to virtualize, but they are telling people to consolidate data centers. And so cloud plus virtualization means whose perimeter are we talking about, whose environment are we talking about? And so, Gijo, I want to start with you. How do corporate entities, that is to say federal agencies or corporations, deal with their cybersecurity when they don't necessarily have physical ownership of the underlying infrastructure?
Right. First, I want to say, you know, every IT paradigm shift, and let's not, you know, I think everybody agrees here, this is a huge IT paradigm shift moving from on-premise technology to cloud and virtualized technologies. Every shift that we've had, look at moving from mainframe to distributed or distributed to the web, the top priority was security, right? Remember all the back in the day, people used to say, I'm not moving my data off the mainframe because it's going to go in all these distributed systems and I don't really have control over that. So what's happening now is that we need to ensure that we have the proper controls as we move to cloud and virtualizations, just as we did moving from mainframe to distributed and distributed to web. And I love, Pete, how you said it, is that all that stuff still exists too. So how do we integrate all of that back legacy stuff into this new paradigm around cloud and virtualization? So when we look at cloud and virtualization, two things come to my mind, really. When we talk about security, you either need control or you need visibility. And if you don't have one of those two or both of those things, you don't really have security. So how can we start to say, either have organizations give me control when we start leveraging cloud computing, which might be hard because you may not have control of the infrastructure. If you don't have control, how do you give me visibility? And then that's the second question. So we got to press folks that we go to for cloud and virtualization and say, how do you give me the visibility? For example, if you know, I'm virtualizing storage, or I'm virtualizing applications at another data center somewhere in the cloud, how do I know my data is not commingled with other data? How do I know my applications are only accessible by people that I want to access it? And that kind of visibility is really hard to come by. And what we need to do is make sure we enable that. The other big problem is one of privileged users, right? Today, we internally implicitly trust everybody that we have in our organization, right? The IT administrators, the folks that have access to our databases and so on. I'm a big fan of trust but verify. So what you need to be able to do is also manage these privileged users. Now imagine you're taking advantage of cloud-based computing and these administrators at the other end of the table or the other end of the cloud may not be the people that you know and may have privileges to the entire set of systems there. And they could do whatever they want with the data. They could do whatever they want with the application. So privileged user control is really important.
And so let me ask you, Simone, is this something that you feel can be put into a service level agreement, for example, not just uptime and that kind of thing and speeds and response time, but also visibility into the security posture?
I think certainly service level agreements can start to address some of the things that were just mentioned, but there are still some fundamental questions about how to actually implement security on a cloud. There are certain issues surrounding virtualization and the types of controls that can be implemented in these infrastructures. So I think there's some more fundamental questions that industry is still working quite hard to address. And service levels will only get you so far because you can't specify in a service level agreement some capability that simply doesn't exist at the moment. I think longer term, the industry does have a very strong economic incentive to solve these problems, to strengthen the security models for cloud computing infrastructures, and I do believe that that will happen. Shorter term, I think just the natural inherent need to manage risk and to effectively control risk for federal government systems means that there's going to be a mix of different types of applications used on different types of infrastructures. The first types of things that are done out in the cloud are probably going to be low sensitivity types of things, dissemination of public information, and it might be a while before we see some sensitive type of applications hosted out in clouds. And there's also a mix of different types of cloud computing models that can be put in place, ranging from a completely outsourced model to a private sector hosted but federally managed model to a federally owned, federally managed, completely private cloud model. And I think that we see some of the agencies that have the desire to capitalize on the economic benefits of cloud computing and yet the needs for high levels of security, looking at those types of federally owned and managed private clouds to really strike that balance between the economic benefits and the need for security.
And Pete Goldman, the State Department operates in every time zone. Plus, you have different levels of information. There's the fully private and personally identifiable, and the confidential and the secret. And then there's administrative data, financial data. So you have almost a two-way grid to evaluate data, how far away it is, how much control you can have. If it's hosted locally, 19 time zones away from headquarters, for example, I guess that's actually 5 away if you look the other way. And then you also have, you know, what is the data itself? How sensitive is it? So in considering cloud and virtualizing options, how do you overlay those with the types of data that might be suitable for those types of hosting and application?
Well, I think it all begins with the information value, as you're basically alluding to, is the importance of that information, how sensitive it is to what you're doing. And I don't think the State Department's unique in that. Even the global aspect of that doesn't put us into a unique environment, because if it's in the continental United States, that sensitivity still exists. And so one of the key challenges in looking at the cloud is providing the same type of data privacy that we operate with when we use our internal networks. And while, you know, using a cloud infrastructure is very similar in nature to outsourcing, and we've done that for many years across the government, there's still this degree of, as Gijo pointed out, either you have control over it or you have visualization into what's being done with it. And I think finding ways to leverage that and make a determination by adding on basic security protections based upon the level of the importance of the information will drive the decision process of what can effectively be handled in a cloud and what can't.
And Brian, I think you talked about the idea of identity having some connection with the location that data is accessed from, and those things relate in some way because the data is tagged and the ID of the person is tagged, and we are talking about identity-based security here. So can that be overlaid? Can the policies that control ID management and therefore what resources someone has access to, is that reproducible in an environment that you don't control directly, like a cloud?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if we back up for a second, I mean, if we're looking at information technology, we can go down the traditional path of either doing a product buy or build, or we can look at it from a service-oriented standpoint of identifying the service-level agreements that we want, and essentially also the certification of the platforms, and also the from a visibility standpoint, the continuous monitoring that we need. If we put those things in place, then we can have the appropriate authoritative capabilities of the data with the credentials of the user. The fundamental thing, though, to get to that point, we have to do the homework up front, which is the authoritative data sources and the inventory of our assets in terms of things like the physical devices, the operating systems, the applications, the data, the licenses, the maintenance agreements, the circuits, and the security classification, whether it's high, medium, low, or national security. Once we do that, then we can look at the data center optimization capabilities, enterprise licensing, the cloud computing services that we can go out for based on those classifications, and then put in the appropriate PKI management that we would have for the users and the appropriate encapsulation and key management for the data that could be stored in theory anywhere at that point.
Okay, well, let's move on then. I wanted to also ask you about the non-traditional channels of communication that seem to be taking over. It seems to go with all of these devices, and that's, of course, social media. In fact, the way they market some of these devices is that it lets you do your social media anywhere. You know, you don't have to be near a computer console anymore. And how has that affected this whole issue? Because people's personal and professional lives can blend in kind of an uncomfortably close way. Anyone that has a Facebook account knows that. Brian, let's start with you in the Air Force, where there have been specific policies deployed for use of social media. And we're not talking about banning, but we're talking about safe use. So how does ID management and data protection come into this new brave world?
The Department of Defense did release a policy on the use of internet-based capabilities. And those are guidelines in which that we're applying in terms of social media capabilities. As we move in that direction, I think what will be the change we'll see is that we'll be focusing more around communities of interest in terms of how we share information, and that'll be driving the security and privacy parameters rather than the traditional organizational boundaries that we've seen within our communities. So I think there'll be a need to cross those boundaries a lot more in those areas. There is a need to separate the professional from the private side. At the end of the day, our mission is to protect and defend the United States. So there are capabilities there that don't necessarily mix into the private side. So we need to make sure that we have appropriate controls around the data and the social tools that we support. From an internal standpoint, the social media tools that are on the external side, we can apply a lot of those type of capabilities internally within the communities of interest that we have, and have those capabilities available for the mission that we support.
Yeah, it's safe to say that, Pete, at State Department, there is deployment of those technologies. You have a lot of development going on for social media within State Department. You're not using the commercial services, but you're using those technologies and architectures for your own internal collaboration purposes. Does that, so you're safe there. What about external use of these things? Because what we've found, you know, especially in the terrorism era, is that it's amazing how little shred of information can be useful to someone who does not have your best interests at heart.
Right. And that is a challenge area. But one of the things that's really important to point out is that there aren't really good, effective technology solutions for human problems. And so what I mean by that is that a user is a necessary partner in the protection of information. And this hasn't changed, right? So for many years, back into World War II, we had concerns over what people were saying and who they were saying it to. And that's the whole operational security aspect to this. And it doesn't change when we move into a Web 2.0 capability or we start using social media aspects. Users have to be aware of the potential misuse of their remarks. And to that end, we do training on that. And so we have a policy in the State Department on the use of Web 2.0 capabilities. There are policies throughout the federal government for that. And we employ capabilities within the department, one of which is a sort of like a tip reminder each day that we can queue up with security tips or any type of particular thing that we're trying to get out to our users to pay attention to and say, you know, alter your behavior slightly. We can put that out there to users. And so we think that this is really a amalgamation of technology, some policy perspectives, and really the wisdom of the users in making good decisions in what they do with information.
And Simone, how does the Commerce Department deal with the convergence of social media and devices that are outside of your direct control?
I think the most important thing to do is really to accept that these technologies are there, both the technologies from the perspective of these services and these websites, in the case of websites, as well as the device part of it, and to really just make sure that we're putting the right policy frameworks in place to deal with them, and also doing a large amount of user education and awareness, which I think is sometimes where shortfalls are in terms of making sure that information is being adequately protected. We've been revising our policies internally to the department to do, as was mentioned before, the effective separation between what's personal and what's business, so that we have official department websites on some of these social media websites, and then people can have their personal lives. And it's just important to keep those adequately separated to make sure that you're not speaking on behalf of the department if you're not empowered to do so, to make sure that official views of the department are on the official websites, not personal websites, those types of things. And I think it's still definitely an area in which we're trying to grow our own understanding and get to where we think we want to be.
And G. Joe, we've talked about encapsulating data with the security parameters that we need for use corporately. Can that be extended? Is there a technological way to extend that to social media?
I'm sorry, Tom, what was that question? I was tweeting a second. I'm just kidding. There technology, it's a hard fit for technology and social networking right now, because it's not just about the data or the technology that we could apply to that, because how people get to social networking sites and how they use those sites are kind of beyond the control of just the organization that they belong to. So what we found, and I'll give you an interesting story. I was at an organization 2 weeks ago, and the HR administrator was in the meeting with us, and she basically said, while we're all in the meeting, she was talking about how she works. And she was saying how she emails payroll data to her personal Gmail account so she can do work at home. And she said this with a smile, and didn't think any security implication of that at all. But payroll information has things like social security number and other really sensitive bits of information that everybody in the room who's involved with the security, their jaws just dropped to the table. So it's not necessarily a technology issue. It's sometimes an education issue and an awareness issue. But where technology can help is to kind of enable some of that awareness a lot easier. So at another organization, what we've done is every time somebody did something suspicious or, you know, looks like, I don't want to use the word stupid, but, you know, if it's something silly with the data, what we did was pop up a warning to them just at the time that they were about to use it. So in that case with the HR administrator, when she clicked send, we could have had the technology say, wait a minute, this looks like personally identifiable information. Are you sure you want to send that thing out? And then, you know, education works best when you're about to do something when you need it. That's when we were able to provide that type of protection. So we can help educate and keep people aware with the technology and to support the other types of training that we have.
Yeah, nothing like an exclamation mark inside a yellow triangle makes people stop in their tracks and say, maybe I don't want to do that. You're listening to a panel discussion on identity-aware data loss prevention, how to manage and protect sensitive information, presented by CA Technologies here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We're going to take a short break and continue the discussion in just a minute. I'm Tom Temin.
How do you keep your infrastructure safe without limiting your people and productivity? CA Technologies lets you control every use of every IT asset by everyone who accesses your systems. Can you say yes to new capabilities? Can you enforce defense in detail, not just defense in depth? Can you empower your people while protecting your systems? With CA Technologies, you can. To learn how, visit ca.com/gov/value.
Welcome back to the panel discussion on identity-aware data loss prevention, how to manage and protect sensitive information, here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, presented by CA Technologies. I'm Tom Temin. Our guests today are Gijo Matthew, Vice President of Security Strategy at CA Technologies, Simone Zickman, CIO at the Department of Commerce, Brian Burns, Deputy Director, Warfighter Systems Integration in the Air Force CIO Office, and Pete Goldman, National Policy Coordination, Office of Information Assurance at the State Department. And we have really covered a lot of ground today, but there's a couple of spots I want to still get to, and that is how we overlay ID management, protection of sensitive data, and the whole issue of telework. And you all have organizations in which really a fraction of the people actually exist in what you could call headquarters, whether it's the Pentagon or Maine State down in Foggy Bottom. And so there are a lot of teleworkers by office or by home location. How do you deal with that, especially when there's a push on for a lot more telework? Pete, why don't we start with you?
Well, the department has embraced telework now for a number of years and actually supported it greatly. And we've set up a access capability to our systems that allow people to get into the sensitive side of what we do, and sensitive being the non-national security world. And we've set it up in such a way that people can do so with great flexibility. They can come in from a home computer as opposed to a government-issued computer to kind of keep costs down. And we do so in such a way that their whole transactional experience is portable, so that when they're done, it's done. It goes away. So we don't have to worry as much about leaving remnants of the data wherever people are working from. And we found that to work very well, and we're actually in the midst of looking at different ways we're going to go forward with that, having been on that platform for some time, and extend further capabilities out to the users if we can do so securely.
Simone, what's your telework strategy with respect to ID management and data safety?
Well, I would say there isn't one strategy. I would say there are a large number of different approaches. And if you had to boil it down to a strategy, the strategy would really be to tie the mechanisms, the way you do things and what you allow to be done, to risk and have that be an effective linkage. We have, in different parts of the Department of Commerce, different missions and different levels of security needed to support different types of missions. At one end, we have at the National Institute of Standards and Technology a large research community where some of the types of things that are done by teleworkers are just authoring research papers that are ultimately intended for public consumption, and that's the kind of work that somebody could just sit on their home computer and do, and there's no real risk there. In other situations, we have the need for people to be using government-furnished equipment so that we can ensure the security and the configuration and, in some cases, encryption of those IT systems. In other cases, we have VPN technologies that allow people to remotely connect from their home machines to some central location. And in other cases, we have yet another approach to supporting telework, which essentially just provides a secure connection to an individual's actual desktop sitting in their actual office. And so there's never any actual work being done on the remote machine from which they're connecting. It really ultimately ends up being just a long-distance monitor for their secure and managed desktop machine at the office. And I think there doesn't need to be a single strategy as long as these different types of approaches are effectively tied to the risks involved, both from the perspective of the kind of work that people are doing and the kind of data that they're involved with.
And Brian, in the Air Force, is the secure socket layer VPN kind of the answer to all of this, or what's the strategy?
Well, we have a variety of mechanisms we use for secure communication for remote capabilities. We are fully supportive of telework when it fits the environment. We look at the parameters in terms of the type of data that the individual has to get access to, also the interactions they have to do on a daily basis, and we're very supportive of teleworking on a regular basis or even an intermittent basis. And we put the appropriate security controls from the CAT card reader to other type of technologies to provide secure communication in those remote areas.
And Gijo, what are some of the best practices that you see across domains, including government, with respect to ID management for the remote worker, the teleworker.
Right. I think the point of being able to manage identities has to be a little more dynamic and based on roles. So it's not just about, you know, how what they do today. It's about how they change their or evolve their access rights as they go forward in their organization. So they're a teleworker and they're working on a specific project and they do something that gives them one set of entitlements. But as they shift, you know, how do you dynamically change your entitlements to make sure they stay? They still fit the confines of a teleworker, or they fit into the data sets they're allowed to get access to. I'll give you an example of something that happens in organizations a lot today. Many organizations use SharePoint, right? So maybe you let people go in VPN or get access to a SharePoint site, and your rule says, yeah, you can have access to the SharePoint site. Rarely do people have rules that say what you could post, that what data you could post to that site. And most identity and access management technologies actually stop there. They say, we know who you are. We've given you access to the site. Now go have fun, right? What we need to start doing is tying what we talked about earlier back to identity as well. So how can we bring in the idea of content and data and tie that back to the identity that has access to that share? So, for example, what we're doing at CA is that we can tie what the data is on that SharePoint site all the way back to the user and his role. So maybe he has access to that site today, but somebody posted up personally identifiable information and he shouldn't be seeing that. Even though he has access to the site, we can say, wait a minute, there's a new file here. It's got PII. We're not going to let that user get access to it, though, even though the access management system said he could.
So it sounds like ID can be applied both to the individual, and there's also the ability to ID the machine as well.
Right.
So you could have an authorized ID person on an unauthorized machine, and that could influence the rights that they have and the resources they have access to.
Right, absolutely. And then not only that, that may change the way you want to authorize that person. And you may say, well, just with ID and password, you can get to this set of data. But, you know, we want to step up your authentication to something else if you're going to access more sensitive information. So that's the way we handle, you know, to add on top of what Brian and Spohn said about the bigger strategy of protecting teleworker and information. It's really a best practice strategy to kind of tie that all the way down to the data and then offer different types of authentication mechanisms based on what people are trying to do.
And we also touched briefly on encryption. Encryption seems nowadays to be like mayonnaise. There's nothing you can't spread it to. And people talk about encryption at the cell level or the row and cell level in a database, or you can encrypt whole hard drives. And so forth, and you can encrypt ID information. But there's a management component to encryption, and sometimes a pretty considerable cost, especially for, you know, password generators that are tied to a server as opposed to your own password and so forth. So how do you, what's the strategy or the process by which you would arrive to a good encryption plan? Pete?
So encryption today is sort of heavily like the armor that you put on when you go outside and you need protection. So if I have data that I'm concerned about where it's transiting, it's going out to a location that I don't have control, and I want to be sure that it goes through that without any problems and gets to my intended destination, encryption is a good concept to apply to provide that kind of protection. There are challenges, though. I mean, there are export restrictions on some encryption technologies that we have here in the United States, and we have to be mindful of that. And there's also the necessity to be able to get access to information. Worst possible scenario, have an employee who is doing a great deal of sensitive work and has everything encrypted and is the only person that has the key. And then that person goes away and you've lost all that work. So there is central overhead to manage how you're handling your encryption capabilities. You can't just let people go out individually and acquire these capabilities. It has to be centrally handled.
And Brian, what's your take on encryption? Because it gets to be complicated when you get to the details.
Encryption is one of the key components of securing the data, but it also, in addition to that, there's these, I'll call it the semantic attributes to go with that data too, that we have to look at. So the combination of those things, it's not one any individual thing, but it's a combination of how we'd use the data, how we tag the data, how we'd encrypt that data to send the packets appropriately through the communication layers that we need to communicate the information to the warfighter in whatever situation we're in. So it is a key component to what we're doing. It is obviously from a data at rest standpoint and also any type of mobile data, it's a good way of protecting the data at one layer or one in-depth capability.
Simone, is it possible to have encryption inculcated into your activities and processes without making this huge effort on the part of users?
I think that it is possible, but it does take effort. And so in some cases, it may be effort on the part of users. In other cases, it may be effort on the part of doing very large scale re-architecture, and in some cases having to build new infrastructure. The people who are working on the global information grid within the Defense Department are quite aware of the scale of these types of efforts to really build out a new infrastructure that allows large-scale, geographically distributed, well-controlled, well-managed sharing of information in a secure way. I think one of the difficulties that many organizations run into is not having the resources to re-architect and rebuild something on a large scale. The issue of just having to deal with legacy systems, legacy boundaries between organizations, between networks, between domains in an IT sense, and so whenever you try to get information crossing these types of boundaries, everything having to do with encryption and sharing of information securely, key management, all of these things become quite a bit more difficult.
All right. Well, we're near the end of this discussion. I just want to get any final comments you may have on how you roll all this up into your daily thinking. And I guess maybe the question is, who needs to think about this the most? Is it the CIO? Is it the program manager? Whose belly button do we push, to use a military term, in all this? Brian?
It's everybody. It's not just the CIO. It's every user. It's every component. Security has to be a key asset that we take into account whenever we're dealing with any type of information. Privacy is obviously another component of the security that we have to look at too.
And Pete at State?
Well, while it's everyone's responsibility to play a role in security, it's most appropriate that the mission managers and mission programmers take into consideration what their mission success profile looks like without appropriate security, and the risk decision lives there.
Okay, Gijo?
Well, my motto has always been, you know, think strategically about security first, and then you can act tactically. And that's got to be what we need to do, because what's happened in the past with security is that we just build silos of security, and what ends up happening is the cracks in between those silos are where things go wrong. So what we really need to do is think strategically, think about it from an identity-centric perspective, think about it from a data-centric perspective, and then start enacting encryption projects, start enacting digital rights management projects, DLP projects, and whatever it may be.
And Simone, last comment with you.
I don't have anything to add, but I did want to tie together to the comments that were just made, which is that I think in terms of the strategic thinking, the big picture that looks across the large organizations, that is an essential component and something that I think CIOs are in a good position to provide. But in the end, I also agree that the responsibility for really thinking about the requirements, understanding what's needed, and very frequently having the resources to implement these types of measures does fall with the mission organizations, because very often the systems are not necessarily CIO-owned and managed systems. There are frequently mission systems that are owned by other organizations, line offices, or subunits within an agency. And so clearly, I think what it really comes down to is just having a good partnership at the very senior leadership levels between the programs and the central IT organizations.
All right, we want to thank you for listening to CA Technologies panel discussion on identity-aware data loss prevention, how to manage and protect sensitive information.
Thank you for listening to CA Technologies panel discussion on identity-aware data loss prevention, how to manage and protect sensitive information on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. To hear the show in its entirety and more information, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword CA.